Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Nicole Hardy was single, 35 years old, and struggling with her church's requirement that she stay celibate before marriage. But struggle is very different from action, and that next step would change her life. Justina Machado of 6 Feet Under and the Netflix series One Day at a Time reads Nicole's essay, Single, Female, Mormon, Alone.
Of all the places I felt sure I'd never go, Planned Parenthood topped the list. Because, you know, they perform abortions and give condoms to kids, or so I'd been warned. Yet one spring afternoon found me in its waiting room next to a teenage girl who was clearly confused by the intake form and likely bound for an uncomfortable 4 minutes in the back of a borrowed car. But what did I know? I was a 35-year-old virgin preparing for my own first time, which incidentally didn't happen until I was well into 36. I wasn't frigid, fearful, or socially inept, not overweight or unattractive. I didn't suffer from halitosis or social anxiety disorder. I was a practicing Mormon. And Mormons wait until marriage. So I had waited. Spent the first 2 decades of my adult life celibate and, for the most part, alone. Because only after the trial of my faith would I be blessed with an eternal marriage, which I prayed would also blow my mind in the bedroom. It never occurred to me that I would remain unmarried, especially in a system where marriage is not only a commandment, but also one of life's primary purposes. Turns out, though, that there is no place in that community for a single woman who doesn't want children. My only available choice within the church was to wait for my reward in heaven. As Mormon doctrine promises that single members denied marriage, family, and sex lives on earth will have them after death. Needless to say, this was not a compelling argument. Most troubling was the fact that as I grew older, I had the distinct sense of remaining a child in a woman's body. Virginity brought with it arrested development. Yet like the Russian orphans I'd read about whose lack of physical contact prevented them from forming emotional bonds. Now it felt like celibacy was stunting my growth. It wasn't just sex I lacked, but relationships with men entirely. Too independent for Mormon men, and too much a virgin for the other set. I felt trapped in adolescence. My first act of open rebellion was to go see Brokeback Mountain in Seattle's rainbow-striped Capitol Hill neighborhood with a pair of lesbian friends. I wasn't ready to have an alcoholic beverage or a cup of coffee, to lie with a man or smoke a cigarette, but I could watch a movie, even if that movie was an obvious attack on the sanctity of hetero marriage, with its handsome straight Hollywood actors acting as if homosexuality were not perverse. Because while I am also straight and believe in God, one thing became clear that day. I could empathize with those gay cowboys. I knew, as an unmarried 30-something happy without children Mormon woman, how it felt to grow apart from one's community. I knew what it was to be fundamentally bound to an ill-fitting life, to be the object of pity and judgment, to feel I had no choice but to be the thing that made me other. And to be told that if I prayed hard enough, God would bless me to want what I was supposed to want. Stage 2 of my rebellion happened immediately after the movie at Babeland, our city's world-renowned sex toy store. my lesbian companions were supportive of, if perplexed by, my commitment to the law of chastity. They were protective of my innocence, in the same way another friend once knocked a pot cookie out of my hand. I was not accidentally getting stoned on her watch. But what could be more fun than taking a 34-year-old virgin to a shop selling everything from art glass dildos to vibrating nipple clamps? And what could be funnier than watching said virgin study each product's list of features for water resistance, battery life, noise factor, shape, size, and heft? The few relationships I did have, all with non-Mormon men, lasted only a few weeks. Months if it was summertime and all dates could begin and end outside in daylight, delaying the expectation of physical contact that darkness inspires. The pattern was predictable. At first, men were intrigued, turned on by my virginity, the landscape of uncharted territory, my innocence and curiosity. In certain scenarios, a man believes or hopes I'm playing an elaborate game of hard to get, that the whole thing will culminate one night in a seedy, sweaty, up-against-the-wall scene out of Roadhouse, starring himself as a young Patrick Swayze. However, every time fantasy met reality, these men went in search of something simpler. And who could blame them? We were grown adults. Most of them had been having active sex lives for decades, and it was weird for them. Some would say ridiculous to suddenly be thrust back into the eighth grade. So why wasn't I dating Mormon men? In a nutshell, the pool is small, and people marry young for obvious reasons. The leftovers were left over. Closeted gay men, porn-addicted virgins, along with the merely awkward, uncompromising, and unlucky. My favorite was the movie industry veteran who, after offering me a peanut butter cup, said, "Marie loves peanut butter. You know, Marie Osmond. We dated in college. She was into it, but I just couldn't handle being Mr. Marie Osmond." Obviously, I was left over, too. I was just never sure what my problem was. Until one man let me know. After overhearing a friend and me comparing our weekend horror date stories, he walked up to me and asked, "You know what your problem is?" No, I didn't know what my problem was, and I was dying to find out. "Your problem," he said, "is you don't need a man." I thought that was a good thing, to be able to take care of oneself. He asked if I had a job. Yes, a car. Yes, a house. Yes, clothes. Of course, food, obviously. "That's your problem." "Excuse me?" Men in the church are raised to be providers. We are the breadwinners, the stewards of the household. If you have all the things we're supposed to provide, we have nothing to give you. "What about love?" I asked. "What about intimacy and partnership and making a run at the world together?" "Nope," he said. "We're providers." Regardless of my tragic dating history, the fact that I had no reason to feel hopeful, I tried for 15 years not to lose hope. The gospel was the answer. It had saved my parents, each of whom had converted separately when they were young. Thanks to the Mormon church, they escaped childhoods full of abuse, alcoholism, and neglect. They found God, found each other, and were rescued by a community committed to family, forgiveness, and joy. Out of chaos, they created a tiny space where our family of four lived happily and prospered. I was surrounded by love, taught that I am a child of God, that I have a divine purpose. My whole life, I'd felt secure, fulfilled, purposeful, and connected. And further, I'd made a commitment. Why would I abandon God and His church now, when in all ways but one I had asked and had received? Perhaps the failure was mine. I'm sure many church members see it that way. I was too weak to endure. They'll say I should have waited another decade or spent my whole life alone if that's what God required. I'm just unwilling to believe that's what God wants for anyone, and was unwilling to continue spiraling further into a disconnected life, feeling abandoned, being discounted. Oddly, my trip to Planned Parenthood provided much that the church had not in recent years. During my exam, the clinician explained every move before she made it, asked permission to touch me during the most routine procedures. I was mystified by her compassion, by the level of attention paid to my body, as if it were fragile or sacred. Only then did it occur to me how many terrified and abused women Planned Parenthood must treat every day. And that brought me to tears. Distressed by the ways in which we all suffer, in whatever ways we do, and grateful for the unlikely refuge of this place. Grateful also for the safety granted my own tears, prompted by the delicate weight of a hand on my shoulder, the warmth of her palm against my back. How unprepared I was to experience tenderness in the place I had been warned so vehemently against. How unprepared for the flood of relief, the bud of hope, after a life devoted to keeping myself separate from my body. Here was a path, an opening. Here was empathy. I would have an IUD instead of children. I would have intellectual and spiritual freedom. I would write poems and finally live inside my body. I would, for the love of God, feel a man's hands on me before I died.
Justina Machado, reading Nicole Hardy's essay, Single Female Mormon Alone. More from Nicole Hardy after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After Nicole Hardy's essay was first published in the New York Times, she got a book deal. The title of her memoir, Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin. Now, she knew that putting her words on such a public stage would have wide-reaching ramifications. It could have endangered her future in the Mormon Church and maybe even destroyed her relationship with family and friends.
My father is the only member of my immediate family, as far as I know, who has read my book. And I gave him a special redacted copy where I took a razor blade to the spine of the book and I took a Sharpie to certain words and phrases and paragraphs. And so I gave him a copy that has all of the emotional and spiritual struggles, but none of the sex. And he said he felt really grateful that he didn't have to be fearful of turning the page, because that allowed him to really understand what went wrong for me. And to their credit, I'm still part of the family, but I don't feel like they know me as intimately as they could. So there's a certain amount of not asking and not telling around the Christmas dinner table.
We asked if her parents received any pushback from the Mormon community. Nicole says quite the opposite happened, especially the Sunday her piece was published.
He said he walked into church and a woman approached him right away and said, "Does your daughter write for the New York Times?" And he said, "Well, she doesn't write for them, but she has an essay in the paper this morning." And she said, "I read it and it was beautiful. And you should be so proud." And I think the reason that story was so important is because I feel like it surprised him. That because I think he was expecting judgment or silence. And I think the thing that helps he and I continue to have a good relationship is that he can imagine a world where I can be who I am and still be loved by God.
Nicole no longer considers herself a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. Spiritually, she's still searching.
I'm not sure what I believe anymore, and that, strangely, is really a relief. I was sort of told my whole life what I believed in for a long time. That was easy to do because nothing bad ever happened to me and felt blessed and my life was abundant until I changed. Or life got complicated enough that those things weren't true anymore. And all the things that I theoretically believed just became less and less like inspiration, like fulfillment, like joy. And letting go of all those supposed to's and should's felt incredibly liberating. And I don't know if I could sit down and tell you like a list of doctrinal points that I believe anymore. But I love not knowing. And I thought for a long time that the not knowing would be terrifying. But I feel like those are the places wherein the biggest revelations can come.
And Nicole is welcoming more revelations into her life.
And I've traveled a lot. And, you know, at one point I quit my job and sold everything I owned and moved to a tropical island just because it's a thing that people talk about, but it didn't make sense not to do it if you could. And I feel like that's one of the benefits of being single. I still haven't married. I don't know if I will. I would like to be in love someday, but in the meantime, I want to see the world and I want to have extraordinary adventures and I want to be open to the unknown.
So what about her first sexual encounter?
At the time that the article was written, I had a boyfriend and I thought things were going to happen with him. And the more intense it got and the closer it got, it turned out that that was a situation that was very pressure-filled, which I can kind of understand. But I didn't at the time. It's funny because as women, we're always told that, you know, men always want it and they're up for it whenever. And whatever we want is available to us all the time from men. But months later, I met a new man who became my boyfriend. And he had had a really lovely first time. And that had always been super meaningful to him, that it was with someone that he really cared about. And I appreciate that he took a lot of care in making sure that I had that same kind of experience. And we're not together, which is fine for both of us. He's now married to someone else who is probably better suited to him. But a thing that I let go of when I left the church is believing that the person that you're with on the first night is the person that you're with for eternity. And I really believe that he was the perfect person for that moment.
Nicole Hardy. Her memoir is Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin. She lives in Seattle and is working on a nonfiction book about her latest adventure, a year at sea on a 180-foot tall ship with 42 strangers. Don't go anywhere. More in a minute.
The In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. And now let's hear from Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times.
I remember getting letters that were people in similar situations that suddenly an essay like this just releases the floodgates of emotions that have been pent up. It starts out with her talking about how this life and this religion has sort of suffocated her. But then there's a marvelous turning point where she talks about how religion saved her parents and gave her a life, essentially, and that the strengths of the Mormon religion are what saved them and gave them purpose. And she gives you this sort of textured view. Instead of just demonizing religion and Mormonism in this case, and so you understand, you know, you understand her dilemma. It's not something she can just walk away from very easily. It's not something she can embrace. I don't know, by the time you get to the end where she's talking about how she's going to move forward in this life and will feel a man's hands on her body before she dies. It's just so beautifully resonant by that point.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. If you want more Modern Love, join the Facebook community at facebook.com/modernlove. Dan posts some great things there, including an early digital release of the week's essay. Special thanks to Justina Machado for reading this week's essay. We sent her a handful of essays, and Nicole's rose to the top. We asked Justina why.
Well, I mean, it's tolerance and going out of your comfort zone and realizing that it's not so bad. Everyone is going through the same thing. We're dealing with it differently. And if we listen to one another a little bit more, I think we'd find a lot of these stories. So I just loved the compassion and the empathy in this. And I'm a big Planned Parenthood supporter.
You can see Justina in the Netflix reboot of Norman Lear's legendary family sitcom, One Day at a Time. In this version, Justina is a divorced military veteran raising her Cuban-American family in Los Angeles. The entire first season is streaming now. Next week on the podcast, Malin Ackerman from the Showtime series Billions brings us the story of a fake marriage based on real love.
When we reached the altar, the Elvis impersonator stopped his hip-swinging jig. "Do you promise to polish each other's blue suede shoes?" I beamed at my almost husband. "I do." It might have been more genuine, of course, if Ricky had been standing next to the preferred love of his life, a man. But a man wouldn't have been able to help him the way his best girlfriend could.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.